for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. And I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I stand over your grave, and I'm sure that you're dead.
All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. It's July 3rd, 2007, and I got kind of a lazy day for you. There's a speech that took place Saturday, a big hoorah, And yeah, that wasn't like the military cheer. That was like a hoorah, rah, like a brouhaha, only not like the beer. You know, like a happening, a big buzzing, bumbling confusion. Anyway, there was this tax group, something or other, in Iowa that invited all the Republicans out to give speeches and talk about taxes and money and such, and they invited everybody but Ron Paul, pretty much, and three other guys that you've never heard of who weren't even in the debates and are the real completely fringe candidates for the Republican nomination. Not that you're missing anything from what I've been able to find out about those guys. But anyway, for whatever reason, these jerks decided not to invite Ron Paul. And all the Ron Paul supporters bombarded them with emails and spent, you know, all kinds of controversy over the last couple of weeks, articles written, people telling them that they ought to give up their jerky position and do the right thing. And this tax group, Iowans for Tax Relief or something like that, but they wouldn't go back on it. And so Ron Paul basically just threw his own party in the same building on the other side of the building after theirs was over. He didn't, you know, crash their party. He made his start after theirs was gone, but they only had about 600 people show up for the first one, and many of them apparently left when Mitt Romney was done talking, and leaving only maybe 400 or less there to watch the rest of the Republicans, while there were well over 1,000 people that came out to see Ron Paul, people from all over the country, in fact, went to Iowa to see it. And I haven't gotten a chance to watch the speech yet, and so I figure I'll sit here and watch it while you sit here and listen to it, and if that's the kind of thing you like to listen to. Otherwise, tune it back in a couple hours, and there will be some death metal for you. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 Austin, Texas. This is Ron Paul, last Saturday in Iowa. Here in a second, I mean, it will be momentarily. Ron Paul!
Comments about the individuals who have helped put this together. First, I wanted to thank very much Jim Guest for coming. State Representative Jim Guest for coming and speaking. And also, the campaign staff have done an especially good job. You know, Kent Snyder and Lou Moore and Joe Becker and everybody that has helped. They really deserve a round of applause.
By the way, you can all watch this speech if you want. The YouTube is at the blog at lourockwell.com.
And I have two of my grandchildren. And we have, my wife is with me, but we have 18 grandchildren. One is very young, like a little over a week old. We have one great-grandchild. We have two grandchildren here today, Mark and Valerie. If they would stand up. Now, my wife Carol's here today, and she and I celebrated our 50th anniversary just a couple months ago. A lot of people wonder whether she encourages me or discourages me from what I do, but quite frankly, she's been very encouraging. When I was doubtful about what to do and what decision to make, she was always very supportive and encouraging, believing that the message was worthwhile and that I could present it. And when I would have doubts, she would always encourage me. And even today, when I have a day where I'm rather tired and I dread going through the security line at the airports, she says, no, you need to go. So she's really been a big encouragement to me. It's interesting that, you know, in New Hampshire, the film that you just saw, they have a slogan on their plate, license plate, born free or die. A great slogan, of course. But, you know, the motto for this state, Iowa, I think is very interesting and very good. Our liberties we prize and our rights will maintain. That is great. Went through the various states, you would find many, many great slogans, and they emphasized one thing, the responsibility of the states. These were written in a time when states assumed a lot more responsibility for the protection of the liberties, and hopefully we can return to that status. Today we want to celebrate, and we want to be very positive because freedom is positive, and this is what this is all about. Not only is it a very positive program, but we also should have a lot of fun, and so far it sounds like you're having a lot of fun. But we're here to talk about life and liberty, and quite frankly, they're inseparable. Because how can you have liberty without life, and how can you have decent life without liberty? So the two go together. And, of course, we all know life, liberty, property are very, very important. That is the essence of liberty. But there's sometimes debates on exactly where our lives come from. I have a personal belief. I believe every one of us, each and every life, comes from a creator. And therefore, our right to live is a natural right, and governments are instituted for a very limited purpose, and that is to protect life and to protect liberty. And that is what is the magnificent of our Constitution, which was very limited in scope. It wasn't a license for government to do all the things that they do today. It was very narrow, and that was the genius of the Constitution. And not only was it there to limit the government, it was also there to sort out the difficult problems, not in a centralized, monolithic state in Washington, D.C., but it was to be worked out at the local level, where people had a handle and more control over their government. You know, the importance of life, I think, is crucial. There's been an ongoing debate for the last 30 years about, you know, whether life prior to birth deserved protection. And I want very, very limited government. I don't want very much government in Washington, but as an OB doctor, as somebody who's been involved in politics and somebody who has concern for life and liberty, I find it difficult not to defend a life a minute before birth, just as I would defend that life a minute after birth. But this is... There was a case in the news where a woman was murdered and her baby, her fetus, or she was pregnant. The fetus was killed as well, and there were two accounts of murder charges made against her. And so the fetus does have a legal right. And I think this is very important. I know as a physician, as an OB doctor, if I would ever have done anything to harm the fetus, I had liability. So this is a very legal thing. But, you know, to me, it's more of the confusion, the message that we send out to the next generation. Because we're saying that you can pay me to take the life a minute before birth, but if the young woman that might throw her baby away, a minute after birth, we arrest her. And there's an awful lot of inconsistency there. So, to me, it's recognizing the importance of life. when we can preserve life, then we can deal with all the issues of personal liberty, and that, of course, is what we're interested in, and how do you preserve liberty, and we all feel blessed that we have had the opportunity to live in a country such as America, where we've had a more generous approach to this issue than in any other country. It's just that we have a lot to do before us to preserve that liberty, but I do not believe for a minute that we cannot, that we will be able to achieve that task, preserving that liberty. You know, there are a couple things in our law today that emphasizes the point that we no longer own our lives. We're no longer responsible for ourselves. The welfare warfare state introduces that notion that we have the nanny state, that we don't have responsibility to make our personal decision, that we take responsibilities from the parents on education and medical care and all these things, that we deliver it to the government. And that just undermines the whole principle of individual liberty and the right to life and the right to live and the right to be responsible. But one of the areas which I think is most abusive of this concept is the idea that we now live in an age, now for a good many years, way too many years, where it is acknowledged that the federal government owns all our income and we're permitted to pay a certain percentage. That is the terrible notion of the personal income tax, which we should get rid of. The notion that we own property, but in truth we don't. We don't own it because we can't use it the way we want. We have to get permission. We either have to pay huge taxes on it or ask the government for 25 permits before we can even dig a ditch on our own property. So we have really undermined the concept of private property. We've undermined the concept of contracts and the marketplace and the free market economy, because the government has so many regulations and rules about hiring and firing and pricing and transportation and all these things. So it is... we're at a point now where the concept of private property has been seriously undermined. And we cannot reject this notion that owning property is key to the survival of a free market economy. Another area that we have allowed ourselves to ignore another basic principle about who owns us and who's responsible for us. And that is the idea of selective service and the military draft. As long as that is on the books, that is telling the world, that is telling the country, and is telling especially a segment of our population that we discriminate against those young people who become 18, and all of a sudden they're required to sign up with the state to be available regardless of the ill-advised war that we must get into. I'm saying we get rid of the draft and... You know, in the debate so far, we have not talked a whole lot about the significance of our economy. They did ask a question or two about medical care. And I was waving my hand, suggesting, well, maybe I'd like to talk about medical care, but I didn't even get to talk about it. So we haven't talked a whole lot about the economy and very little about taxation, unless I brought it up. But you know, I believe we're really facing an economic crisis. In spite of the fact... the government statistics tell us that everything is wonderful. There's no inflation, no significant unemployment rate, no worry about jobs. Forget about the deficits. Deficits don't matter. Don't bring up this silly notion of sound money. That is irrelevant. They go on, and yet, if you think about it and you talk to your neighbor, or maybe look at your own financial situation, you realize that this country is not nearly as wealthy as we think we are and other people think we are. And you think about it, everyone in this room, if you had a generous banker, and he was willing to loan you $1 million a month and never ask you to return it, we could all look pretty prosperous. But bankers can't do that. After about 2 or 3 or 4 months, he might call the loaner, quit loaning it to you, and all of a sudden you're seeing a really changing. This is the way this country is operating. We're operating on the idea that we have permanent prosperity. We have rejected the notion of free market capitalism and sound money and savings. We save nothing. But we have prosperity by overconsumption, by borrowing money. Not only individually, but by the corporations and by our government, and we're passing on these debts to the next generation, but we're borrowing, our national debt's going up approximately $500 billion every single year. We're financing a war by borrowing from places like China. We have to borrow between $2 and $3 billion every single day to finance our current account deficit. That's how much beyond our means that we're living, and it works fine. Until they quit loaning to us. And then all of a sudden, prices will go up and interest rates will go up and there'll be a lot of inflation. Some of you in this room, I'm sure, remember well what happened in 1979 and 1980. In order to protect and save the dollar, they had to bring interest rates up to 21.5%. And unemployment rate was 12%, was the worst condition since the Depression, and we had inflation rate. They admitted to the prices were going up at a rate of 15%. Today they claim, no sweat, prices are only going up 2.5%. But in order to get to those numbers, we have to fudge the figures. We have to change the calculation of the CPI, and we have to omit housing and energy and food. So if you don't eat, you don't drive, you don't have any medical bills, then you don't have much inflation to worry about. We spend way beyond our means. And that is a reflection that we as a nation have accepted a role for government that was never intended. We have endorsed the notion that we are to maintain endless, perpetual, growing welfareism. And that we have endorsed as a people the notion that we have a worldwide responsibility to spread democracy and police our empire, and quite frankly, it will end soon if we don't quickly change our policy. It's going to end anyway because it's going to bring us to our knees in a bankruptcy. So the sooner we end that notion that the federal government should police the world, run our lives, and run the economy, the better for all of us. That the federal government assumes they own every single penny of our income and allow us to keep a certain percentage. And the way they collect taxes is obviously unconstitutional. The idea and notion that we're all guilty until proven innocent and that we are literally compelled to be slaves to the government by producing records on our employees and all the onerous things that we have to do. But there is another tax and there's another system that we have to address. And this is the area that a lot of people make fun of what we say in our campaign. Matter of fact, I've only been saying it since 1974 in every single campaign I ever ran. And that has to do with monetary policy and the need to get rid of the Federal Reserve System. On TV all the time, and I'm sure you've heard it. He's the guy who wants to go back to the 19th century, live in the dark ages, and have commodity money. But you know what? The whole idea of paper is so silly, ridiculous, and dangerous, I can't imagine how the people can accept the notion that a government that nearly everybody in the country now distrusts turns over to the government this power to work in collusion and secrecy with the central bank and create money out of thin air to pay the bills, and then they wonder why we have problems. it makes a lot of sense. It's even in our own history in the United States, the founders had bad results with inflation. They knew what happened to the continental dollar. The continental dollar went to zero, and the slogan, hey, it's not worth a continental. And they had runaway inflation. So they were very interested in the monetary issue during the revolutionary time in terms of writing of the Constitution. And that's why they precisely said that they could not invent bills of credit. Only gold and silver would be legal tender. And historically, they knew it led to trouble when you allow governments to debate to destroy the currency. So historic history is on our side, and there's been never a paper currency ever persist for long periods of time. It always destructs. It's always entertaining and interesting to me to see when they dig up a vessel at the bottom of the ocean that's been there for 500 years, and they find these barrels full of gold coins, and guess what? They're still worth an awful lot of money. You know? Sound money. There's a moral reason. It's deceitful, distrustful for governments to participate in counterfeit because they are debasing the value of money. They're stealing from us. It's a form of taxation. So it's a moral reason. One of the debates they asked about what tax we would like to get rid of. And of course, I had claimed that I had already addressed the subject of the income tax, and we took care of that one rather easily. So I brought up the subject of the inflation tax. A lot of people don't quite understand that. How can you call this a tax? Well, when you spend beyond your means, you can tax so much, you can borrow so much, and then they still come up short, and then they print. That lowers the value of the money. And who suffers the most when the price is going up? Do the people in the government? No. The people in government, the politicians and the bureaucrats thrive on it because they spend the money first and the value of the dollar is still higher. As the money circulates, then of course the people who are mainstream, middle class, poor people, get the inflation tax. Their prices go up. So truthfully, I believe their inflation right now, their cost, the loss that they have to purchase power of their dollar, probably well over 10%. So somebody is literally stealing from them 10% of their hard-earned income every year. That's why they don't want the secret out of the bag, because this is a gimmick that they've been using and will continue to use. And it serves the interests of special groups. And say that you happen to be in the military-industrial complex, and the money is spent first, and you happen to be a Halliburton or some other company. You get that money when it's still maintaining value, and they did not have to force more taxation. They just printed this money, so there's a tremendous benefit, and that's a transfer of wealth. The characteristic of inflation, destruction of currency, is that it wipes out the middle class. All we have to think about is recent history of South America and Central America and our next door neighbor, how destructive it has been to Mexico. Just think, if we wanted to deal with our problem of immigration, maybe if the Mexican government, and matter of fact, there's a move on in Mexico to have a sound currency and a healthy economy, that would do a lot to solve our problems here in the United States. Of course, if we don't deal with that problem of trade and immigration and all our good jobs leave and we have everybody coming here believing that we are prosperous and we have a crisis, we really will have a job on our hands because the entitlement system will not be able to be maintained. There's not enough working people, not enough young people to finance this perpetual entitlement obligation that we have. But the gold standard and the Federal Reserve, the lack of the gold standard, the Federal Reserve literally causes a business cycle. It sends out information that is totally destructive. It causes interest rates to go lower than they're supposed to be. And without even having savings, which is a signal for people to invest or a signal to spend or save or whatnot, we have no savings essentially, and yet interest rates are low. In free market, if you have no savings, interest rates will be high and send out a certain signal to the business people on what they should do with investments. So the Federal Reserve sends out all this misinformation to our business people that they can make money on the short run and they can benefit by this transfer of wealth, so they don't really care about the business cycle and what might come 5 years or 10 years or 20 years down the road. They'll worry about that later on. But the inflation, the booms and the busts, the Great Depression, the inflation, you call it the wars, this is all, none of this can happen without the Federal Reserve system, and the more reason why we have to work to get rid of it. But one of the... reason why we have to think about the money issue, and that is it enhances the growth of government. Because they don't have to tax us directly, and because they don't even have to borrow and they get to inflate, they also get to spend the money. So the average politician benefits from this. He goes home and says, I voted for this, 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 and this, and I didn't raise your taxes, so therefore I deserve re-election, and tragically, most of them are still getting re-elected. You know, they're getting re-elected, and yet, irresponsibly, the government keeps growing. We've been able to delay the penalty, the real detriment to this system, because it doesn't come immediately. And the people who suffer are the innocent people. They're the poor people who don't have a lobby. They're not the Wall Streeters who benefit from this. The other category of people who benefit tremendously from this monetary system are the banking interests. Because not only can the government create money out of thin air in order to pay the bills for the government, that the transfer of wealth also occurs because banks create credit out of thin air. They can have, if they have $100 of your money in your checking account, they can loan that out. Maybe $90 of it, so they have $190 in bank just like that. In true market, free market banking, you have $100 in your checking account, you're the only one who has access to it unless you loan it to somebody through a plan on a CD or something like that. So this is quite a bit different. This is why there are powerful special interests that want to protect this monetary system. But the market is on our side. When we reinstate the free market and liberty and the Constitution, we will not have this type of monetary system that we have today. The most important thing is if we get the right thing, if we get the right people in office and we work a transition, it doesn't have to be painful. But under today's circumstances of moving in this one direction of a national bankruptcy, this sets the stage for chaos, runaway inflation, the kind of conditions that have happened in Germany and Central America. We're not immune from that. We're not that bad off, and we pray that we never will, because it's destructive to liberty, because then people use that as an excuse for more government. But if we do, or when we have to make these changes, what we need are a lot more people like you around this country who understand the principles of the Constitution, the principles of sound money, and the reason why we have to get back to the basics so that we don't have this destructive monetary system. I've talked about foreign policy, and some of you know that I put many of those statements together in a recent book dealing with foreign policy, because it is very, very important. Because if you have conditions where we're fighting war, liberties are always undermined. Randolph Bourne made a statement many years ago. He says, war is the health of the state. And if war comes, there's always excuses to expand the state. And sometimes those who would like to expand the state don't mind for a minute to have a war or two on the books so that they can expand the state. But, you know, in the debates, at one time where I elicited a mild bit of a response from that mayor that used to be up in New York City, in some ways, in one sentence, I think I've more or less summarized everything I put in the book. And that is a concern about our policy, I said, the subject of our being attacked. And my statement was simply this, they are over here because we're over there. So when we have a downside to our foreign policy, even though we have to defend ourselves against these violent attacks on us, and that is recognizable, but that should never divert us from these more serious thoughts about how do we get ourselves into those situations that precipitates this act of violence against us. Because once there's a Pearl Harbor or a 9/11, you can't just say, oh, well, let's forget about it. We can't do that. But we should keep our eye on the ball, and we should ask the serious questions about how this came about, could it have been prevented, and what can we do to end the mess that we have now, and how can we keep this from happening anymore? I talked a lot about what's going on in Iraq. On the debates, as well as many, many hours on the House floor for many, many years. A lot of times I'll be interviewed by a TV commentator, and they might not be up to date on exactly what my positions have been over the year. And they said, but did you vote against the war? And of course, the real answer is, I voted against the war probably 15 years before it started. And because we were looking for trouble for a long time, even with the Persian Gulf War, which is really the beginning of this war over here, which was the beginning of the 9/11 episode, because we went in there, it was a terrible thing that was happening over there, but we went over there to protect our oil. And of course, what did we do? We left some troops in Saudi Arabia. And guess what? Our old ally, Bin Laden, turned against us. Can you imagine that? Here we had been his friend and helped him when he was trying to chase out those Russians out of Afghanistan, and now we're in his country, his home country, and we have an air, a big military base in there on their land, which they consider holy land, and they highly resented it. So this was just stirring up trouble. And then, of course, after we chased the Iraqis out of Kuwait, we continued a bombing episode for years after years after years. And then, of course, in 1998 was when I really began to speak out about the coming bigger war. And the Clinton administration had the Congress vote on what they call the Iraq Liberation Act. And this was brought up under suspension, supposed to sail right through, and nobody was supposed to say a word about it. It was just to say, he's a bad guy, and our policy now is for regime change in Iraq. Of course, there was no evidence that Iraq had done a single thing to us. He was no threat to us. He had no capability of ever attacking us. But we as a country accepted this recommendation from the administration that we would now work for regime change in Iraq. And I spoke out against it because it was under suspension. I got... under suspensions, and both parties supported the war, this proposal to eliminate Saddam Hussein, I got the 20 minutes in opposition against those, the rest of them, who had 20 minutes to divide up among all of us. So, it gave me a chance to express myself and make the record. Unfortunately, I didn't persuade a lot of people. But this is the way it works. It takes a long time for them to agitate and promote the war propaganda, convince the people of falsehoods and scare the people. And, of course, it eventually came. And if you check the record between 98 and 2003, I did my very best. In fact, when it came to the International Relations Committee, I obviously took the stand. I had been talking about for 5 years. We don't need to go to war. We shouldn't go to war. But I said to the committee, I said, if you think you should go to war, what you should do is do it in the proper manner. What you should do... What you should do is have a vote on an upper bound declaration of war or not. So I accommodated them to give them their opportunity they were looking forward to get the vote on that. So I offered the amendment to declare war. I told them I wasn't going to support it. If they wanted to go to war, that's what they were supposed to do. Well, one member chewed me out and says, don't you know, Ron, that part of the Constitution is anachronistic. We don't even follow that part of the Constitution anymore. And somebody else said, that is frivolous. That the idea that he brought the Constitution up as a frivolous idea. And somebody said, you know, that is so impractical. And, of course, nobody voted to declare war, but they were ducking their responsibilities. The responsibility falls on the Congress to make this declaration. So they delivered this responsibility to the president. They were amending the Constitution. They literally said to the president, do whatever you want. And, of course, politically, they thought they were going to get plenty of cover. Well, if the war goes bad, they would say, well, it's the president's fault. If it goes well, people would say, oh, we supported it. But right now, you notice there are a few of them swarming with their indecisiveness and their hypocrisy that they took over many years ago. But the policy of non-intervention is the policy of the Founding Fathers. It's the policy of the Constitution. Matter of fact, there is a very, very strong strain of non-interventionism in foreign policy in the Republican Party, and let's remind them of that. Politically, peace is a winner, war is a loser. And, quite frankly, the Republican Party has had more benefits by taking the opposite position that they hold today by arguing the case against what the Democrats have done. And yet now, the Republican Party, tragically, is in the position of defending a war that is indefensible. And they now are having a bit of trouble because of that, and there's no way that the Republicans can continue to do well without resolving this. But the Republican Party, just think, after Vietnam, after Korea, Eisenhower ran on, I'm going to get this war over with, I will go to Korea, I'm going to stop this. So the blunders of the Truman administration were corrected by Republicans coming in. Vietnam in 1968, that's what the election was about. Nixon didn't do his job, but he was elected because the country was sick and tired of a no-win war. Undeclared, no-win, illegal war was draining us financially and draining our troops and everything else. So the Republicans had a political benefit from that. What about the year 2000? Where were we politically in 2000? I mean, our president was running on a program. Well, this Clinton, he's a terrible guy. Look at the mess he had in Somalia, pretending the nation bill, involving in the internal affairs, policing the world. I, as president, Bush said, I will have a humble foreign policy. And that won in the election. People were reassured. I actually thought, yeah, that sounds good. I sort of like that. That's what I want. But here we are, as a party, in an indefensible position, and of course, I'm making a suggestion now and then that not only should this country, would this country not benefit from a change of policy, Republicans could benefit as well if they would change their ways in this regard. The strength and the conviction and the rightness of the right to life movement. Life is precious, and we should preserve life and allow life to come in. And yet, at the same time, I mentioned the fact that many of those same individuals are very careless about anxiously having the selective service and having a draft. You know, one time I had a debate on the House floor with conservatives who were all in favor of the selective service. I was trying to fund selective service. And I chastised them a bit. I said, you know, I said, in many ways, you think more of your guns than you do of your kids. You don't want your guns registered, but you want the government to register our kids. But we should never forget the teachings of the Christian Church about a just war. The Christian Church, in my understanding, there's always room for debates, but in my understanding of my Christianity, that I do not have to accept total pacifism, that I have a right. If somebody walks in my house, I can defend myself. And the Second Amendment protects me on that, too. And that we as a nation have a right, if somebody's going to attack us, if they are even an imminent attack, or if they do attack us, we have a right to protect ourselves and use violence against this threat of violence. The big problem is that when we go too far and spread ourselves thin around the world and consume our wealth, it undermines our national defense, and that's where we are today. Our military is ill-equipped, and their morale is low, and of course, if we want our guard unit to protect something on our borders, or if we need a guard unit to take care of an emergency weather problem, where are our troops? They're over in the Middle East. We need to bring them home. We would like to bring home. How about those 120 to 150 border guards that we took off our border and sent them to Iraq to train them to protect the borders over there? We need them home as well. But in the just war theory, there's a set of standards that we should follow. I think they're very reasonable. It's reasonable to have a defensive war. If we're attacked, we can do it. But the response should be proportional. And one thing is interesting is that the doctrine says the proper authority should declare the war, which means that we should strongly resist the fact that we now, including this transfer of power to go into Iraq, I resent very much that we send our kids over there to enforce UN resolutions. That's bad. Matter of fact, the best way to deal with that is not trying to pick and choose which are the good resolutions and the bad resolutions. It would be best for us and our national sovereignty and our interests just to get out of the United Nations. I said that Borden said that health is the war is the health of the state. Inevitably, even throughout our history, even before this 20th century, war did lead to the undermining of our personal liberties during the Civil War period, and certainly World War I and on. Sometimes we recapture those liberties and sometimes not. So whether it's a war overseas, our civil liberties are threatened. Whether it's a war against drugs, our civil liberties are threatened. If it's a war against our right to own our guns, it's a violation of our civil liberties as well. But I am afraid we're in worse shape than we were even when Wilson abused the rights of Americans, because he was an abusive president in that regard, and some of those rights were recovered again. But today we are told that the war is endless. We don't know who the enemy is. We don't know where they are. There was an attack today, and the suggestion was that it might have been by Pakistanis, by two individuals. It's all that was on the news. So they're saying, oh, that's part of the war on terrorism. I mean, Pakistani, it could have been Indians, or we don't know. But the idea that two individuals have excited us to practically get ready for the next war, I mean, it is totally endless. War on terrorism is not a war. Terrorism is mere tactics perpetuated by various individuals. And once it's, we are told by our own government that this war is perpetual and it's indefinable, it's worldwide, which means they want license to go anywhere they want, anytime they want, and they expect us to be there to pay for it and send our kids, and it's time that attitude ended. They said, we will take nothing off the table, even a nuclear first strike against a country that is incapable of threatening us. I mean, we have to come back to our senses on this. Why are we so scared? Why are we so intimidated? We don't need to be. We should be confident. I mean, we're capable of defending ourselves. We have a policy that has been designed, deliberately or not, who knows why these things happen, that literally rewards people who have nuclear weapons. Pakistan has a military dictator. He overthrew an elected leader, so now he's our friend. We go into Afghanistan, instead of going after Al-Qaeda and going after Osama bin Laden, we occupy the country for the interests of oil companies, and then what we do is we go and we support the Iraqis, you know, and support the regime that we have there, pretending that this is going to bring sensibility back to the situation. But at the same time, we reward those people. We look at Pakistan, who now is harboring Osama bin Laden, we send that money. And they sent technology to Korea. North Korea is now playing games with us. So it seems like we as Americans have only two choices. That is, either we bomb them or go to war or we subsidize them. Why don't we just leave them alone? Immediately after 9/11, the attack on our civil liberties became very determined. And the many, many bills that were passed were not new proposals. They had been around. They were not brand new. But the 9/11 attack was the excuse. And it wasn't hard to gin up the eagerness in the American public. And many members of Congress knew that they had not studied the bill. They couldn't have. We only had an hour or two to look at it, and it wasn't even really available to us. But when the Patriot Act came up, when I asked him about why you're going to this, you haven't even had a chance to read it. They said, well, the American people want us to do something. If I don't vote for this, then I haven't done anything. And besides, it's the Patriot Act. I won't be patriotic if I don't vote for this bill. So they voted for it. And then we start worrying about what it has done. And it has done a great deal of harm. And it's on the books. And it's not the kind of thing like they did in World War I, where many of these things were reversed. This war is perpetual. It's going to last a long time. They're not about to change their tune. Why is it now that we have warrantless searches? Why do we have the rejection of habeas corpus? Why do we have this notion that even information that is obtained under torture is admissible in court? And why did we, as a Congress, change the Insurrection Act? The Insurrection Act had for many, well, since 1807, I believe, that it said that the president has the right to declare an insurrection, an emergency, with the consent of the governors and the Congress. But now, it's only under the consent of the president. Anytime, and for very lax reasons. For medical reasons, for weather reasons, public order, they can declare martial law. And then you can be held, American citizens can be held as enemy combatants, and which means that the stage is set for American citizens to be held without due process and even being heard before a judge. And very, very dangerous. And quite frankly, I don't think we're going to see that massively abused in the next few months or even a year or two, but the idea that we're moving in that direction, we have no idea why. What was the purpose of removing those protections? if somebody didn't think it was a good idea as a, you know, protecting whom? Protecting the state. We're supposed to be existing, the government's supposed to exist to protect you, not the state. This country was born as a republic, and that is very important. We have democratic elections, and that is important, but just the election process. But rights cannot be determined by a majority vote. Once you do that, you destroy the rights of the minority. And certainly our republic and our constitution didn't come about to protect an empire. That contradicts the whole notion of a republic. And it is a time, we live in a time that is going to be very, very difficult, and our lives and our fortunes are going to be challenged, and we will have this opportunity to express ourselves in this campaign, which I think is very important, and reasoned, I think, to be a bit optimistic. There are a lot of people in this country, a lot more than I ever dreamed, that are very, very interested in these views, and we should be pleased. There has been some, I believe it may have started in Arizona, and they talked about a revolution. And I like the idea of a revolution. Even Jefferson advocated on occasion you need a little violent revolution, but I'm not for violence. I'm for nonviolence, but I am for revolution. I want revolutionary changes, even if it is only going back to the goodness of our Constitution. Unfortunately, that's revolutionary. Revolutions throughout history, and they're usually carried out by a small group of individuals dedicated to certain principles, and they usually get challenged. But the first challenge they get is they are totally ignored by the establishment, by the status quo. And, quite frankly, we as a group, our views have been totally ignored for a long, long time. But let me tell you one thing. I think the period moving away from that of ignoring us has passed. They can ignore us no longer. The second stage is usually that of ridicule. And I'm sure many of you in this audience have been ridiculed for your belief, for you standing up for principle, for even joining in this campaign. Why would you support these silly notions? And on TV, I have been exposed to a bit of that. My goodness, you support that, you know, on and on. So the ridicule has been going on for a good while. So we are literally in that stage. But I think we're moving gently over in the direction of the next stage, which is when they fight us, when they literally, you know, ignore, then they ridicule, then they get worried, and then they might fight us. Bring it! A philosophic fight, of course. But, you know, when you think about it, immediately after the first debate, somebody in Michigan, anybody remember that story? Somebody in Michigan said, we need a petition, we need to get that guy off the stage. You know, he doesn't represent what we believe in, and I have to confess to you that was true. But they wanted to, of course, silence us and our movement. And yet, they now, of course, have done something rather recently. So they failed to invite us to some of the parties that they have. So sometimes that leads to having a bigger and a happier party. find it a bit ironic that those same individuals who would like to undermine the democratic process of elections here are the same ones who are quite willing to send your children and your dollars overseas to spread democracy to the Middle East. They try to ignore, they can't do that anymore, the ridicule isn't working, and they are getting a little tougher. But then in the end of the successful revolutions and ideas has always been that you win in the end. It has been said by Franklin, that it's a very dangerous notion that you can be made safer by the sacrifice of a little bit of liberty here and there. That attitude is unnecessary. We are always much safer if we're free than if we ever concede to sacrificing one drop of our liberty. Political activity should be very singular. It should be for the promotion of liberty. No more complicated than that. And for our benefit, it's very simple. I, as an elected official, it's not complicated for me. If my goal is to protect your liberty, all I have to do is fulfill my oath of office and obey the Constitution. I've been especially excited about the campaign, and I've always admitted that I was probably one of the most reluctant, not understanding how pervasive the ideas have spread, how many people we could get involved, and yet it is doing wonders at what is happening, and the internet is tremendously beneficial. Some people come along and they say, well, we're going to study the Ron Paul campaign to study on how they did this. They said, you know what? We didn't do it. You did it. The other thing that's exciting about the campaign is the fact that young people are coming. The next generation are coming. They've been kicked off. They have come to realize that they're getting the bad end of this deal. They're inheriting a mess. They're inheriting debt, bad money. The government has abused it to their personal privacy, their personal liberties. They understand about the real ID and the invasion of privacy on the internet. They understand that government is pervasive in their lives. And they also know, young people are starting to realize that they can add up a little bit of arithmetic, tells them, well, there's $70 or $80 trillion of obligations, and their numbers are slightly lower each year. Where is the money going to come from? It's going to come out of their hides. So maybe, just maybe, this new generation that is coming in will be on our side in the preservation of liberty. And that to me is really exciting. They on occasion call me Dr. No. And people say, well, is that good or bad? I said, well, I don't like to be negative. I want to be positive. Now, I told my wife this, and she knows about it, but a lot of my staff loves it. And she said, well, there's no problem. Just tell them it's spelled with a K. The ideas of liberty are young. The ideas of America are very young. So I resent this negative approach. Oh, you're going back to the 19th, 20th century? Yeah, he would be a good candidate in 1832 or something. And true principles aren't dated. And the principles of liberty are very young. You know what is old-fashioned and what is ancient? Is tyranny. Authoritarian. Respect for the individual is what is key. But the secret to liberty is the assumption of each and every one of us to assume our responsibility to be self-reliant and dependent on ourselves and get support from taking care of ourselves and taking care of our families. That's what counts. When you have... When you have liberty, it releases the creative energy that we all have to one degree or another. Each one of us have creative energy, and our responsibility is to use it to our best ability. And every one of us will have different creative energy. I was on an art show today, and I admit it, I have no ability whatsoever in art. Others do. Others have ability in music, and that is great. Every one of us have abilities, but they can only really be taken care of in a free society. When government comes in and takes care of us and say that they're going to make us better, the economy's fair, and the world better off, they can only do that with the sacrifice of personal liberty, and it undermines every one of us in the individual sense. And that is the whole principle that we have to struggle for. If we have liberty, then we personally are obligated to work the best we can for our own excellence and work in a virtuous way. When we live in a tyrannical society, it undermines that incentive. It takes away the ability of us to operate because the government consumes us. The Constitution was designed never to restrain the people. The Constitution has been designed for one key purpose, to restrain the government. I see the Constitution as the glue that brings us together. I would venture to guess that this is a diverse crowd. There are probably people coming from all walks of life, and yet some are Republicans, some are independents, some are libertarians, some are constitutionalists, some may even be Democrats for all we know. But the whole idea of coming together is brought together by the glue of the Constitution. We can come together, and if we have disagreements, we should discuss them. And we should, in a very deliberate, calm fashion, change our Constitution. But when we embark on the notion that the government is supposed to be doing so much, and the government has so much power to wield, and that they ignore the Constitution, then we have nothing but a near anarchy in the sense of how they rush to Washington to consume our wealth. And this is what has to change. And we should be able to get the large majority of the people to support the Constitution. And the young people, I think, are excited about this. I'll ask them, I get a lot of people now to my office in Washington, and many of them are teenagers and college kids, and they come in. I said, why is your interest? And I ask them all these questions. They said, well, I saw you on the thing. I said, what was it? They said, well, we'd like you to talk about the Constitution. And these are young people. But I think all of us like guidance. We like to know what the rules are. And if we don't like the rules, we should have a way to change them. And that is what we call the rule of law. So we have two issues going. We have our liberties and we have our individual items. But we have to find out the best vehicle to bring about these changes. And the Constitution is by far, the best, but still very imperfect. The man is imperfect, but the vehicle is there for us to change it when we need to. But the other vehicle that they gave us, the founders gave us, is that we don't become dependent on a centralized government. The government should be our government over our lives and over our families and our friends and our neighborhood, but the rest of the government should be very, very local. And under those conditions, we can sort out a lot of these problems. One time in the debate, they asked something about stem cell research. You know, once again, it's up there. You get two choices. You either prohibit it or you subsidize it. Why don't we let people and local government make these difficult decisions rather than some bureaucrat politician in Washington? What about energy? People ask me, what's my energy plan? Well, you know, I think the market should be deciding the energy plan. You know about prices, how prices work? They say, well, you know, they might not develop an alternative source. Well, how do you know? They develop a lot of other things in the marketplace. But the governments don't have to have an education plan, a medical plan, an energy plan. They should have a plan for the government to get out of our lives and leave us alone so we can solve our problems. And I've talked a lot about the problems. We have the tax problem, the spending problem, the size of the government, our civil liberties, our foreign policy doesn't work. True to my word, I'm an optimist. I believe that we can do a lot. I believe more is happening in this campaign than I ever dreamed. It's still early. Maybe a lot more may even come about in the near future. We have quite a few months to go. But the one thing that I'm firmly convinced of, I know my limitations, but I also know the unlimited benefits from freedom. And that's what we need. We need more freedom, not less freedom, which means we need less government and more individuals in Washington from the president on down that will obey their oath of office and design all their activities for the preservation of liberty. I thank you very much for joining me in this effort.
everybody. This is Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9. I'm Scott. That's the Beastie Boys. And preceding that was a great speech by Dr. Ron Paul. And, you know, a couple people posted up on the blog that they were kind of annoyed that I was playing the whole speech. And I guess I can see how somebody might not want to hear that on Chaos Radio all day. But I figure Ron Paul's doing the real yeoman's work and spreading the message of liberty around. Seems like I sort of feel like I owe it to him to try to support as much as I can and, you know, give people driving by the chance to hear what he has to say. And, you know, I should go ahead and mention, I don't know why, but anyway, I do disagree with Ron Paul about the abortion issue, but I can pretty easily understand where he's coming from, seeing how he delivers babies for a living and is not an abortionist, but, you know, delivers them alive and that kind of thing. And so I can't really hold his opinion against him. It's a very strong one. And after all, his argument makes sense from the point of view of, you know, when a life begins and when the state should start protecting it and all that kind of crap. Like, if you accept his premise, then his argument's sound. But I don't really accept his premise. But I do agree with him that it's not really a matter for the national government. And that perhaps does mean that if he was president, he would work with Congress to limit the jurisdiction of the court and overturn Roe versus Wade that way. But even if he did, there would still be many states that would keep it legal. I'd say probably be about 50-50. And you know what? That's just not my issue, man. Fuck it. I don't care. You know, that's on the very end of my list. So anyway, that's the only place where I really disagree with Dr. Paul. But the rest of the speech is just great. Natural rights, just an assertion, self-evident truth, you know, that kind of thing. Right about Iraq all along, against the first Gulf War, opposed the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998. And I remember watching him on C-SPAN in 1998 saying, this is going to lead us to war. That's what this is a first step toward war. What are we doing here? This is not right. And he said we should leave Iran, North Korea, and Pakistan alone. He says we either subsidize or bomb pretty much every country in the world, and we have to just knock it off and just leave these people alone. You know, to think that he's the extremist for saying what's so obvious, it's pretty strange. He advocated for gold money and an end to central banking in this country, an end to the government's monopoly on the right to counterfeit money, steal the value of the dollar right out of your pocket. Came out on the record against the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and the provisions in the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act that gutted the Insurrection Act and Pax Comitatus. He mentioned, and I know this is true from the anecdotes, the way I hear him, that people begged him to run. He didn't want to run for president. He wasn't planning on running for president. People begged him to run. Said, you know, gave him the "you're our last chance" speech, and he said, all right, fine. Which makes him different than all the other candidates for president. And, you know, he ended with the message of liberty unites us no matter who you are, if you're a leftist or if you're a right-winger, if you're a conservative, if you're a moderate, an independent, if you just got here from Sudan. What do we all have in common? The Bill of Rights. That's what needs protecting. The rules set up in the Constitution. You heard him. He said, hey, you want to change the Constitution? Fine, change it. You know, our government denounces any country that changes their constitution, particularly if it's in a way that's to the detriment of what they perceive to be American interests. They'll denounce them. How dare you change your constitution? The Russians, they're talking about perhaps changing their constitution. What's their constitution? Just because in America we treat our constitution like nothing but a symbol, and don't even bother amending the Constitution anymore, but instead let our Congress and our presidents and our courts act like the Constitution created their offices and told them they could do absolutely anything they want from there on. the fact that they completely ignore the Constitution. They call it a living Constitution, which means it's dead, really. It means it's not the law. It just looks nice. They say, well, Article 1, 2, and 3 that create our offices exists. Trust us, but never mind the rest of it. And so he's saying, look, no matter who you are, you got to be able to agree with me that the Constitution is a better way to run things. A rule of law under the Constitution is better than just letting the Republicans and the Democrats take turns doing whatever it is they want to do with us and with the rest of the people of the earth. That's no way to run your country. That's a prescription for, in this day and age, totalitarianism, not just... authoritarianism, but pervasive authoritarianism. And you might have noticed, I know Ron Paul has, that we're headed that way. And you know, he also emphasized that not only is the message of liberty and the message of reinstating the Constitution and restoring some semblance of some kind of old republic that may or may not have ever existed, is also his, I think, overriding point. It's what he really finished with in that speech, is that liberty works best. And even if you don't believe in, we hold these truths to be self-evident or sacred and undeniable, or, you know, however John Locke and the Scottish Enlightenment guys phrased it, or Thomas Jefferson and the guys in the Declaration of Independence. If you don't believe that, yeah, still, why not pretend? It's better than believing that, well, we're all just determined to be bossed around by someone who happened to gain power. And the fact of the matter is, and really American history proves it, that the more property rights you have and the more individual liberty you have, the better off your society will be. People point to injustices and the Industrial Revolution and all that kind of thing. It was all an improvement in the standard of living. Pretty much, with some exceptions. But for the most part, that was all just progress. And look at how much capital there is now, despite all the fascism we have, despite the fact that our government steals $3 trillion a year from us. Just think, how many people in America make their living off of music? Off of playing music, off of owning a studio where bands can come in and make their CDs and distributing them and selling them and everything else. How many people? 20 million people? 30 million? I have no idea. I'm just guessing. But that's because of property rights and liberty and capitalism, that people don't have to grow their own tomatoes all day and grow their own chickens and in order to have breakfast. They can play music and then trade their services for goods, you know? Anyway, liberty does work. It's just like the old thing, I forgot who came up with it originally, probably Bastiat or one of those. How is Paris fed every night? How's Austin, Texas fed? Who keeps Austin, Texas fed? It's not the local commissar of grocery distribution and rationing. It's the market. It's people operating their own self-interest. I'm the produce manager around here, and it's my job to make sure that you have the ripest onions and tomatoes and heads of lettuce that you can get. That's what keeps Austin fed. Capitalism. Liberty. Not government. Not rationing and distribution, redistribution, or anything else. And that's really Ron Paul's overriding point. And in fact, I think the Ron Paul campaign proves it. Ron Paul is campaigning for president saying, hey, 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 we barely need a government at all. Freedom works. People will create their own natural orders and get things done. And then what happens? Everybody proves him right. Thousands of people join the Ron Paul meetup that he had never heard of. There's a gigantic, spontaneous pro-Ron Paul movement in pretty much probably every county, every congressional district in this country. There are fans of Ron Paul doing something to support his campaign. There's proof of natural order for you right there. You know, the only people supporting Romney are people who think that they're going to get paid when he's in power. And the same thing goes for McCain and the rest of them. And I guess there are probably some true believers out there, but I think mostly those are just, well, frankly, people who've been duped. It's been a long time since John McCain was any sort of straight talk express. And even when he was, what was all his straight talk? Except we ought to wage more aggressive war. And we ought to, you know, do it in a more efficient fashion somehow. But, you know, Rudy Giuliani, his support is all hollow. A little bit of hero worship from him completely failing on September 11th, putting the emergency command headquarters right in the middle of the last New York terrorist target. Real smart thinking there. And, of course, betrayed all the rescue workers, the firefighters, and salvage operations guys and so forth, who were breathing pure carcinogens without gas masks. And somehow he's still a hero. But you look at Ron Paul's fans, you heard, and, you know, I went to a Ron Paul fundraiser here in town not too long ago, a few months ago, and there were, you know, guys who look like probably old millionaires and gold standard guys and punk rockers with big purple mohawks and, you know, patriot kooks and all kinds of libertarians and college students and people of all races and, you know, quality of standard of income and what have you. They all came out. Same thing with that video of that speech of Ron Paul in Iowa. People of all different descriptions coming together because they know, one, they agree with what he's saying, and two, they believe him. And they know that he's not George Bush saying humble foreign policy with his fingers crossed behind his back. They know that he really means it. And, in fact, I guess there's not going to be time. I wish that there was. But if you go to the LouRockwell.com blog, there's video of Ron Paul in an interview from 1988 when he was running for president in 1988. And it's just great to watch him. He gives the exact same answers. And on his non-interventionist foreign policy, even, the hypothetical question, it's 88. I love the timing on this, right? It's 88. And the questioner says, yeah, but what if, Mexico went communist and allied themselves with the Soviet Union? And Ron Paul's answer, I'm paraphrasing, was good. Then they'll collapse that much faster. They'll overextend and collapse that much faster. Look at them. They just got their clocks cleaned in Afghanistan. They're on their way out, that Soviet Union, and if they took over Mexico, so much the better. They'll be out of our hair even sooner, he said. Which just goes to show that back in the days of the Cold War that he saw through the ruse that was America's so-called containment policy. He said, oh, you want to defeat the Soviets? Leave them alone. Let them run themselves into the ground. What if Mexico went red? What are they going to do, invade us? Give me a break. Anyway, so, yeah, check that out. That's at the LouRockwell.com blog, the interview of Ron Paul from 1988, and it's just a great interview. He actually gives all pretty much the same answers you hear him giving in 2007, 19 years ago, basically giving the very same answers, except, of course, on the Cold War question, but really great stuff. There, and, okay, so that's all I got to say about that, man. I like Ron Paul, that's all. You know these Humvees that they got our guys driving around patrolling Iraq in are pieces of crap, right? That they're basically made out of aluminum. Y'all know about hillbilly armor, right? Where American soldiers go digging through the trash looking for pieces of metal and even plywood. Plywood. To reinforce the trucks that they're driving around in. And now, I never fought in the Korean War or Vietnam or anything like that, but I think it's my understanding that they drove Jeeps around behind the lines, not in battle. They didn't go patrolling in Jeeps, did they? In hostile territory? Humvees are just bigger Jeeps. That's all they are. They're to replace the Jeep. I'm pretty certain those are for behind the lines. And we can see this even in the very earliest days of the Iraq War. I think it was Mike in Tokyo Rogers, but maybe not. But I remember someone pointing out back in 2003, wait a minute, we got guys in armored tanks giving away soccer balls to the kids while guys in Humvees are on patrol in hostile territory. Who's in charge here? What the hell is going on here? And, you know, there's an article here on antiwar.com today. It's in the bottom of the front line section there. It's from the Raw story by David Edwards and Will Meneker. Pentagon hides piles of IED-shredded Humvees from the public. On American military bases all across Iraq, the shredded wreckage of scores of Humvees damaged by IEDs and other explosive devices lie under tarps, hidden from public view. Much like the coffins of soldiers killed in the line of duty, the Pentagon refuses to allow images of the physical toll of battle to be seen by the public. CNN, which I saw this report that they're summarizing here the other day, CNN highlights the vulnerability of the Army's most prolific vehicle and the familiar story of the lack of pre-war planning through the story of Army Reserve Captain Alan Vaught, a Dallas trial lawyer who was deployed to Iraq in 2003. Vaught was stationed in both Fallujah and later Sadr City and saw firsthand how unprepared the Army was for an extended insurgency. Vaught broke his back when an IED destroyed the poorly armored Humvee he was riding in. In a letter home to his mother and father during the first month of the war, Vaught expressed his fear of riding in a Humvee with only canvas doors, writing, quote, "It's getting worse here in Fallujah, and we don't know why. I thought we were supposed to be greeted as liberators." Vaught has no doubts where the munitions that kill American troops come from, explaining that Iraq was littered with open bunkers filled with tank shells, RPG rounds, and other explosives that were looted because of the lack of American troops needed to secure the country in the early days of the war. While the number of so-called up-armored Humvees in Iraq has increased from 235 in 2003 to over 8,000 now, the Pentagon now claims they need at least 2,000 more. And they have a video clip here from the CNN documentary that played. It's called Battlefield Breakdown. The Raw story's got a clip of it there. And, boy, you know, this is something that's always bothered me, putting myself in the position of American soldiers who thought their job was defending America and all that, fighting for freedom and all that. And they're put out patrolling hostile territory in aluminum Humvees. And I think I read a couple years back where a Marine said, "Come on, guys, let's go play the IED lottery." And, you know, I just think that would be a really crappy way to spend my day. Driving around, basically trespassing at large in somebody else's land, driving around, basically just waiting to get blown up. And then if I survive the initial bombing, and all my friends are blown apart laying on the ground, now I don't even have anybody to shoot at. There's no enemy engaged in a firefight with me. I don't even have anybody to kill. It seems like that would be a pretty tough situation to put people in, particularly 3 and 4 tours worth of that. And the consequences of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the wonderful 8-syllable and a hyphen, thanks George Carlin, euphemism for shell shock. The fact that we have so many people, by some estimates, a third of the guys, which it's what almost 1 million guys have served in Iraq, I think, at one point or another, right? Was it 500,000 or something? A third of these guys are going to have these kind of mental problems. Many of them are going to become cops. And of course, we can see, in fact, Anthony Gregory has a great article up on Counterpunch. There's a link to it at thestressblog.com right near the top of the page there about killer cops, where soldiers come back becoming cops, and then they're getting in firefights with other former soldiers, other veterans. And killing them. Not even firefights. Just shooting them. Got these soldiers coming back and getting government jobs and then killing each other. And it seems like, you know, being sent to patrol around hostile territory in aluminum Humvee and the stress that goes with that might be part of that. And I just wonder whether people are ever going to put 2 and 2 together when we start seeing the consequences of going to war with the army we have. Also wanted to point to this one. And I will get to Scooter Libby here in a minute. God damn. This is from the frontline section at antiwar.com today as well. Baghdad Garage, where drivers swap Shiites and Sunnis. By Yasir Faisal, Reuters. Monday, July 2nd. Shiite driver Basim Mohammed sits by his dusty truck at Friends Garage, an informal Baghdad transit point where passengers are swapped depending on their sect. Not long ago, Abu Ali, an old Shiite man forced by gunmen to leave his home in the Sunni area of Abu Ghraib. That's not just a tortured prison of Saddam Hussein's and George Bush's. It's also a neighborhood. That's where it gets the prison gets its name. Not long after, Abu Ali, an old Shiite man forced by gunmen to leave his home in the Sunni area of Abu Ghraib, turns up in a pickup truck. His belongings are stacked in the back. His Sunni driver is too scared to venture into the mainly Shiite suburb, where Abu Ali will live with relatives. So he has brought him to Friend's Garage. Quote, "I was afraid they would kill my five sons, so I decided to move," said Abu Ali, wearing a tattered brown robe and watching workers carry tables, chairs, bedding, and other belongings onto Mohammed's truck. "I had to use this point of transfer because drivers can't risk going into areas where they may be killed. There is no difference between us, Shiites and Sunnis. I just don't understand," he added, tears trickling down his aging face. Baghdad, a city of 7 million, was founded some 1,200 years ago on the banks of the Tigris River by Abbasid Caliph al-Mansur and has been religiously mixed for most of its history. But since the bombing of the revered Shiite shrine in Samarra in February 2006, communal violence has reshaped its fabric, carving out sectarian fiefdoms. Well, that's just a load of crap. The sectarian war started because America opted for what they called the Salvador option, named after the policy of backing right-wing death squads to murder men, women, and children, and nuns, and everybody else in their way in El Salvador in the 1980s, because, you know, the Soviet Union's first they're going to take over El Salvador, and then we're next. And so they called it the Salvador option, which was to hire the most crazy of the Shiite religious fanatics to create death squads to hunt down the leaders of the insurgency, in the belief that the insurgency was not a typical nationalist reaction to foreign occupation, but was somehow the handiwork of a few Lex Luthor masterminds, and that if only the leaders of the insurgency were decapitated, then the whole thing, and figuratively, I don't mean cutting their heads off with swords, I mean, you know, like the decapitation strike against Saddam Hussein was supposed to do, which of course only killed women and children. You remember that, the Doha Farms. But anyway, they hired these Shiite death squads to go around killing the leaders of the Sunni insurgency. And, of course, they committed mass atrocities, and they used American troops as support to do it. And they made the Sunni insurgency worse. They drove the Sunni insurgency into an alliance with Zarqawi and his Al-Qaeda crazy types. Not that there were ever that many of them, but still. And then at some point, somebody, and I don't believe that it's proven who did it, although I guess the typical explanation, and one that at least is plausible, is that Sunni extremists, Zarqawi type, Al-Qaeda types, bombed the mosque in Samarra, which made matters worse. But that was hardly the start of it. What is this, the Associated Press? No, Reuters. Well, that's just inaccurate to say that the sectarian war started with the bombing of the mosque in Samarra. You know, on my radio show in what, 2005 or, yeah, 2004 maybe even. I think 2005. I spoke with Loretta Napoleoni about this and about her book, Terror Incorporated, and then her second book, about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and the new generation of terrorists, created by American policy in Iraq. And we talked all about how the Al-Qaeda types had already basically communicated publicly and saying what we got to do is foment sectarian war. And this has really come from Bob Dreyfus and Juan Cole and all the other experts on my show over the years, too, that the Al-Qaeda guys had the incentive to, especially when given the excuse by American-backed Shiite death squads, to turn the war into really a sectarian war to try to extend the division between Sunni and Shia as much as possible in Iraq in order to keep the war going. That's always been in the interests of Al-Qaeda, was to have America invade Iraq, and it's in their interest now to try to get us to stay. As Zarqawi said to an interviewer just a couple of months ago, oh no, we don't want the Americans to leave. What? They're talking about getting out? No, no, no. We want them to stay until we can kill a few hundred thousand so they'll really learn a lesson, leave us alone from now on. And so we can build up our forces. And that's been their policy. And of course, American policy has only made what Zawahiri wants possible. We only make it easier. And, to think, look at what our government, with the blind support of the vast majority of the population of this country, look what it has done to Iraq. No electricity, no sewage, no running water, no ice cubes in one of the hottest climates in the world. 4 million refugees, 2 million of which who have managed to escape, another 2 million internally displaced, forced out of their homes, like Mr. Abu Ali here, the old man who is forced to leave his predominantly Sunni neighborhood by mass gunmen after he's lived there all this time, who's now forced to move to a different part of Iraq where he's not worried that his sons will be murdered. America has done this to Iraq. And here we are ready to celebrate Independence Day. And look at us. We're the Redcoats. Is that so hard to imagine for a second? Can people, put down their waving flag for just a minute to think about, what the 4th of July and independence and all that is all about? The British once colonially occupied Iraq just like they colonially occupied this country. And now we're there in their place. Our legacy is supposed to be independence from the British Empire, not emulating it. And of course, you remember what happened to them, right? They lost their empire and got carpet bombed on the way out. They're lucky they didn't lose their rainy little island. And yet here we are, our guys are the Redcoats. Well, modest proposal. How about we grant independence to the people of Iraq? To the people of Afghanistan, to the people of Somalia. And for that matter, to Kyrgyzstan and to Taiwan, to South Korea, Japan, to Canada, to Germany and France, to Britain. To Israel. How about we just go ahead and give the earth back to the people who live on it instead of being a world empire? Well, the argument you can only make right near the 4th of July, I guess, right? Any other time, that would be treasonous, boy. But, boy, you kind of got a point when you invoke Jefferson and say that the Americans were fighting to get foreign occupying forces out of their country. It does kind of seem like that's what all the people fighting Americans are trying to do. And for those who say it's better to fight them over there than fight them over here, well, I guess maybe if that was, based on logic or facts at all, if those were your two choices, the fact of the matter is, as Ron Paul says, because he's right, not just because he says it, they're over here. They came over here because we've been over there. The more we intervene in the Middle East, the worse matters get. Here we are now, as discussed with Bob Dreyfus on the show yesterday, here we are now backing the Sunni insurgency against Al-Qaeda that they had only allied themselves with because we had created the Shiite death squads to fight the Sunni insurgency. And then, you know, I was the one who was wrong, apparently, four years ago, when I've been saying all along that the best thing America can do in Iraq is get out now. That we're only making matters worse. That the argument that, oh, gee, look what we've done to their country, we owe it to them to fix it, is preposterous and false. They don't want us to fix it. They know that our government can't fix it, but can only make it worse, and that's all they've done all along is make it worse. And you know what? Fine. Like, you know, people want to be conspiracists about it. Fine. I'm with you. Doug Fife did it on purpose. When Doug Fife and Paul Bremer conspired to fire not just the Iraqi army, but the entire Iraqi government, yeah, they did it on purpose. If that's what you want to hear, fine. Fact of the matter is, either way, whether it was because Doug Fife is the stupidest guy on the face of the earth, to clean up the language of Tommy Franks, because him and Wolfowitz are complete idiots, or because they're evil and had this plan all along. In either case, you take it whichever way you like. Pure incompetence or a dastardly plot, the longer we stay, the worse matters get in Iraq. By the way, 100 killed yesterday, along with 4 American soldiers. So far, 40 Iraqis killed, it looks like, today, along with 3 Americans. There's also a cover story on antiwar.com today. $900,000 to this company to shred F-14s. Now, is that each? This is from military.com. The Pentagon is paying a contractor at least $900,000 to destroy old F-15s. So maybe it's not per F-14s, pardon me. Maybe it's not per. Still, $1 million to go through and chop up all our F-14s. And why? Well, we don't need F-14s anymore. We got F-22s and F-35s. And yeah, they cost $1 billion, $1 billion, $1 billion apiece. And yes, it's true that our old fleets of F-14s and F-15s were more than a match for any combination of air forces in the world. Had to get rid of all those old antique planes. Never mind that the fact that they're refurbished constantly and updated, you know, continuously. No, those are all old because we have to have F-22s and F-35s now. But what are we going to do with these F-14s? Well, we're just going to have to smash them all into little bitty pieces. Why? Well, it turns out that pieces of American F-14s that were meant to be sold only to allies were ending up in the hands of Iran. And we can't have Iran buying spare parts on the world market for their F-14s. I know what you're asking. What F-14s? Where would Iran get F-14s? Isn't that an American plane? Isn't Iran the most deadly threat to America and whatever in the future, according to the mad bomber John Edwards? And the rest of them? Where would Iran have gotten a bunch of F-14s? Oh, well, you remember they used to be our ally back when the fascist dictator, the Shah Reza Pahlavi, and his secret police force, the Savak, that like to skin people alive for opposing American policy. They used to be our friends back in the days, back when Rumsfeld and Cheney were getting them nuclear technology, selling them F-14s. Back in the Nixon and Ford years. The very same men. President Cheney. The guy who is now the unitary executive decider of America. It'd be hard to call him the president, really, if you read the president's job description in Article 2 of the Constitution. It's hardly what Dick Cheney is. But he's the guy who sold the F-14s to Iran in the first place. Just so we don't lose sight of, you know, exactly what we're talking about here. Prefer if we didn't, you know, that's just me. And sorry, just going through my list. Oh, I guess I should have given out the phone number if anybody wanted to call in, but you don't really have time to now because I'm going to about spend 10 minutes talking about Scooter Libby here. I really, really wanted to see Scooter Libby go to prison, if only for a little while. Somebody told me the other day, ha, see, he's going to jail. See, he says right here, they've assigned him his prison number. And I said, yeah, let me know when they actually slam the cage shut. And of course, that day never came because yesterday, George Bush commuted the sentence of Scooter Libby. He didn't pardon him completely, but he suspended all his jail time. Just a fine and probation for Scooter Libby. No word yet if he's going to go back to work in the vice president's office. And now I'm looking at a brand new headline up on antiwar.com. Just refresh the page. White House won't rule out full Libby pardon. Well, probably most people don't even know who Scooter Libby is, really, or if they do, they don't really know about the story. They don't know why the guy was convicted in the first place, or why he should have been, or should not have, or what have you. Well, here's the thing. He was convicted of lying to the government, and I don't really think that should be a crime, because I don't really think there should be a government. And of course, they lie to us all the time and can never, ever, ever get in trouble for it. So, yeah. But then again, we don't have a rule of law in America. There's, you know, as discussed earlier, it's basically a joke to pretend that the Constitution is the law of the land at this point. The law certainly doesn't apply to the enforcers of it. As Anthony Gregory again details in his article running on Counterpunch about killer cops, they never go to jail. Maybe 1 out of 1,000 killer cops goes to jail. I doubt it's even that many. There is a complete double standard of law. We really do have the rule of men in this country. And so I figure, screw it. As long as we just have the rule of men, I don't really care what you convicted Libby of. Lock him in a dungeon. Send him to Gitmo to be waterboarded until he talks. Okay, no, that's not right. Nobody should be waterboarded. He should be locked up in the Supermax, though. He should have to share a cell with Ramzi Youssef. They're at Terre Haute, Indiana, or wherever they got that crazy man, crazy mass murderer locked up. Well, anyway, so why? Why, Scott Horton? Why so bitter about Scooter Libby? Well, Scooter Libby is Cheney's Cheney. That's what they call him. He was Cheney's right-hand man. And he's a criminal. He's involved in some of the worst of Cheney's criminal activities, and most egregiously, lying this country into war. Now, those who tuned into Radio Chaos in 2002 weren't fooled. But tens of millions of Americans were led to believe somehow, mostly it's their own fault, but they believed liars who told them that Iraq was a threat to the United States of America and that something had to be done about it, and who cited tons of so-called evidence. And the evidence that they cited was not really evidence at all, but lies. And Scooter Libby was an integral part of carrying out that plan to lie to the American people, to somehow put a spin on an aggressive war that actually somehow it was a preemptive act of self-defense. When, of course, there was nothing further from the truth. And they just lied. They said that they knew that in Iraq there were warehouses full of mustard gas, of VX, of sarin, nerve gas. that there were biological weapons laboratories and even biological weapons laboratories on wheels that could drive around and make germs. That they had remote control planes that could fly, apparently, I guess, from Baghdad across the Anbar province there, across Jordan and Israel and the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean to spray the eastern seaboard with chemical and biological weapons. That was the plastic sheeting and duct tape. That was part of the narrative on the eve of war. Go back and Google the plastic sheeting and duct tape. It was a month before the war. It was Homeland Security acting like George Bush was credible when he repeated the Scooter Libby, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith talking point that Iraq could fly remote-controlled planes to America's eastern seaboard and spray germs on, well, basically civil servant, federal civil servants and big media types. Yeah, they're the ones who were apparently the target of this and the ones meant to be most scared, and apparently that worked. I still have somewhere a picture that I tore out of Newsweek of these hysterical, they're all bureaucrats. You can tell all these people, you know, graduated from Georgetown School of International Relations and whatever, all these hoity-toity people with all their advanced degrees, absolutely hysterical, with their eyes as wide open as they can go, with arms full of plastic and duct tape, as they, you know, elbow people out of the way. So they can, you know, try to get out of Home Depot before the riot, before the duct tape riot starts. And people bought that. It was pure lies. And, of course, also the forged Niger uranium documents. I don't know Scooter Libby's exact role in that, but I'd be willing to bet he was in on it at one level or another. All of his good friends and associates were. And the aluminum tubes and the rest of it. Scooter Libby is a war criminal. Scooter Libby's job was helping take the lies of the Iranian spy, Ahmed Chalabi, and stovepipe them, or I guess he was on the receiving end of the stovepipe, to but in on the plot with Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, and for that matter Donald Rumsfeld at the DOD, as they cooked the intelligence, cherry-picked reports out of the CIA's garbage can, basically. They stovepipe all that up to Scooter Libby, who then gave it to the vice president and the president and the media. And when people spoke out to debunk the lies, they moved to destroy them. And it wasn't just Joseph Wilson, but it was also David Albright, a nuclear weapons physicist who disputed their claims about the aluminum tubes. They also moved to target the former UN weapons inspector and a man who tried to stop the Iraq war by debunking their lies, Scott Ritter, and others. But most famously, they went after Joseph Wilson, a former ambassador to Iraq and to a few other places, who was sent by the CIA to Niger to see if it was possible that these forgeries described an actual transaction, and he found that it didn't. And when he told the public that in his article, What I Didn't Find in Africa, that he wrote in the New York Times in, I think it was June of 2003, Scooter Libby was at the, well, I don't know, the right hand, basically, of Dick Cheney in the White House Iraq group, who conspired to destroy this guy by outing his wife as a CIA agent and claiming that he went on a paid junket vacation, you know, as an act of nepotism or something. And it could be also that they just wanted to shut down the CIA's secret nuclear black market monitoring agency company, front company, Brewster Jennings and Associates, that she worked for. Seems like it's likely, to me at least, that, and this is just speculation, but that Cheney saw a way to get rid of two birds with one stone. If he could get rid of Brewster Jennings and Associates, that makes it easier for him to invent lies about Iran if they don't really have any other truth to compare it to. And that assumes that the CIA would be gathering legitimate intelligence about Iran's participation in nuclear black markets and so forth, which I guess is more than should be expected, but still, looks to me like they were at least killing two birds with one stone, and Libby was in on this whole thing, and so, you know, who cares if he lied to a grand jury? I don't really care. Everybody should lie to grand juries. It's not like grand juries exist to protect us from the prosecutors anymore anyway. They're there to rubber stamp what the prosecutors want to do to us at this point. There is no rule of law in America, so screw them. Libby ought to be locked in a cage. But, of course, he never will be because George Bush was in on the plot, as seemed to be indicated by what's-his-name's article in the New York Times yesterday about Bush giving Cheney all these powers of classification and declassification and so forth right during the plot to out Valerie Plame, the CIA agent. So seems to me like George Bush was in on it all along anyway. But that's it. I'm over time. This has been Anti-War Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back tomorrow. Do a little 4th of July show and happy Independence Day. And hope everybody's taking off work this week and relaxing. And if you can, sorry about the rain. All right, here's some music. See you guys tomorrow. Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
There's an army of 200 million marching down the river Euphrates, coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, and I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth.
The pirate ships are sailing on stormy seas. There's a Radio Free America just for you and me. The big radio station are stinking up the air. Confused, let him plot. It's a real nightmare. Say, hi, I'm 80s old. Got on pirate radio, land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling your brave. The Coast Guards are coming. Shut the pirate down. They don't believe in free speech. The FCC's in town. Their axles and their hammers, they smash it all to bits. They want a little battle, but the war's not a war yet. Say, hi, I'm 80s old. Got on pirate radio, land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling your grave. Oh, what are they afraid of? What we need is liberty, not those sticky laws. Freedom from the FCC and their money-grubbing paws. Say, hi, I'm Mickey's old. Cut on the pirate radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC crawling your grave. Crawling there, you perverts. Waving to fight the FCC. Lily-livered scallywags full of mendacity. It's mutiny on the airways. We're scuttling lots of rum. We'll wake them, walk the plank. We're having lots of fun. See, hi, I'm 80s old. Cut on the pirate radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC crawling your brain. Hi, I'm 80s old. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC crawling your grave. Say, aye, aye, I'm 80s old. Got all the pirate radio. coastlines. Aye, Tijuana. Think of what the place. 40 lashes. Gouge their eyes out. Chop their legs off. Aye, Gouge McGillicuddy's my name. Get away from me, project.
Of endless black and slow, the consciousness of those who have gone to the end of reserve.